one-man revolution, a guerrilla scholar warrior, a Renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Hi, Prof. CJ here. Welcome to the Dangerous History Podcast. Going to be another episode in the car, so I apologize ahead of time if the audio is not quite as good as it would normally be, but you got to do these things when and where and how you can do them. And this week I really have to do this thing hit and run guerrilla style in the car during my commute home from work, because it has just been one of those weeks, I'll tell you, and it almost always is. This particular week is the week at the college where I work right before the fall semester classes start of the new academic year. So this is also when faculty come back and work, you know, full week of work days prior to fall classes starting, ostensibly to get things ready for the new semester. But the problem is, they give you so many damn meetings you gotta go to that it severely eats into the time that you have to get stuff ready. And I'm not one of these professors that's got the kind of job where they teach a couple classes a semester. I teach a lot of classes every semester. So it's not like I've got to prepare for one or two courses, and I have no teaching assistants. I have no TAs in my job. I do it all myself. So there's a lot of work that goes into it when you teach the number of classes I teach. And they give you so many meetings. I calculated literally 50% of my work week was spent in meetings. Out of 5 days, 2.5 days, entirely eaten up with meetings, most of which were either totally unessential or were things that could have been covered in 30 minutes to an hour, and you had to sit for two, three hours to get the stuff anyway. I know everyone's job has some version of that, but I'm just making my excuses and playing my little tiny violin, if you don't mind. So doing the best I can to get this baby done in the car. Hopefully the audio will be at least decent enough for me to use. And also, you might hear, as I continue to drive, it looks like there's a freaking apocalypse of thunderstorms about to crap all over me. So if you hear thunder, if you hear rain, if you hear me screaming like a little girl because the apocalypse is about to happen, whatever, now you know why, right? So, gonna do something a little bit different today. I haven't had time to put together a full narrative episode, one of those ones where I go, you know, 30 minutes to an hour in some particular historical topic. I do have some of those that I'm working on for the next few weeks, but I don't have one ready yet. So as I'm driving home, coincidentally, I just had a eureka light bulb over my head moment, I guess yesterday. I've been thinking about a tagline for the show, something, you know, that I could say as I'm signing off, something that I could stick on the website in some strategic places, something that in a few lines or so kind of sums up the basic philosophy of the show, more specifically than just, oh, it's a podcast about history, because duh, but there's, you know, how many hundreds of those are there, right? So what's my niche? What's my approach? What's my angle? What makes it different? Aside from the fact that I just try to be radical and question things a lot, and aside from the fact that I don't mind swearing every now and then, what makes my history podcast different? Well, here's my tagline, which I hope sums up my why. My why I'm doing this, besides just I want to, right? So, I present you Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast tagline: learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future. Learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future. Finally, hit me. You know, it may sound simple. You might be going, that's how could it take you a long time? Well, ever since I started this show, over 2 months ago, I've had in the back of my head, man, I want to come up with some kind of a little thing at some point, some kind of a little slogan, right? Tagline, whatever you want to call it. And so finally it did, after you know, 2.5 months of episodes, and we're pushing, I think, a couple thousand downloads, give or take, already for a show that's been in existence for 2 months. So I'm going to talk as I commute through thunderstorm hell, or on the edge of thunderstorm hell. I'm going to talk about what exactly I mean by this, and hopefully it will give you something interesting to listen to, some food for thought, and give you some ideas of where the show is going to be going as we progress. Learn the past. That's the first step. And to me, this sort of three-pronged statement or sentence, each prong builds on the last prong. So the first prong, the first step is learn the past. It's been said so often in so many various ways by so many people that it's almost a cliche, but I think there's truth to it if you really think about it, if you don't just, you know, write it off as a cliche and sort of ignore it, but really think about it. An analogy along the lines of, when you are born, your knowledge of what occurred prior to you being born is zilch. Totally blank slate, right? Mark Twain said something along the lines of, I was dead for millions of years before I was born and don't remember being inconvenienced in the slightest by it. Right? Nobody remembers anything before they were born. But you're born into this world that's been existing for eons. And even human beings for tens of thousands of generations, and even quote-unquote civilization for, depending on how exactly you want to define civilization, somewhere in between, I don't know, 12,000 and 5,000 years, give or take. There's been, quote, civilized human societies of some sort. And you're born now. So how do you find out what's what, who's who, what the hell has already happened? And I've heard different people describe it as entering a movie that's already been going for a long time, and it's a movie with a very complex plot and lots of interesting characters and plot twists and things. And so what happens if you walk into some movie like that and it's already two-thirds of the way through or whatever, right? You've got to figure out what the hell's going on, who's who, and what are they doing, and why the hell are they doing it? I mean, just imagine you've never seen a movie like The Godfather, and you walk in after it's already been playing for 2 hours, right? How would you know? You've got to figure out as best you can what has gone on before. And obviously, the more accurate your understanding is of what has already gone before you walked into that theater, the more you're going to understand what's going on as you watch, right? So history is the key to find out what happened before. It's like the equivalent of tapping your buddy who's been watching the movie from the start on the shoulder and saying, hey, who's that guy? What are they doing? Except, you know, you do it in a less rude, disruptive way, right? Or the equivalent of stepping outside really quickly and Googling the plot of the movie so you get the gist of it, or, you know, whatever. Right. I've heard it described by some people as also like a soap opera. Like if you jump into a soap opera that's already been going on for a dozen seasons, you're going to have no idea who said, who did what to who. You know, why does that guy hate those guys? You know, these are the sorts of things you hear frequently from people commenting about history and why learn history, because there's always that question of why, right? So learn the past. Things have been going on a long, long time before you were born. And unless you've got a decent handle on what's come before, you're not going to really understand what the hell's going on now. It's that simple. Why do so many people not have the slightest fucking clue, even though they might think they do, about what's really going on in the Middle East today and why things are the way they are and so screwed up and everything? Well, they don't know any history. Or maybe they know a tiny bit of history, but it's mostly crap history. It's not factual. It's not accurate, or it's only partial. It's not a rounded perspective of history, right? So if you really wanted to understand what's going on in the Middle East today, just to use that as an example, you would have to go back at minimum, to World War II. I'm sorry, World War I. Excuse me, World War I. And, you know, I just gave you kind of the Cliff Notes quickie version of that in, I believe it was part 4 of my World War I series. I just gave you kind of the highlight big picture bird's eye view of it. But if you really want to be a Middle East expert, and I'm not a particular expert on the Middle East, I know the basic story of most of the major parts of why things are the way they are there. But if you really want to know it, you know, 10 times better than I am, then you really got to dig in, and you probably have to go back to, you know, Old Testament times, and you got to carry it through the founding of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, and then carry it through the Middle Ages and the Crusades and all that stuff, and the Ottoman Empire almost taking over Europe and at least getting a few footholds in Europe, and take it all the way through to the decline of the Ottoman Empire and into the modern era through the world wars and the foundation of Israel and so on. And you have to actually get a well-rounded picture of all that stuff, and then and only then can you really consider yourself an expert on the Middle East today. So only by knowing the past can you understand the present in any particular subject that you're looking at. That's how you know who's who, what's what, how things work, and so on. You learn the past. Not only do you find the backstory of specific current events that we're watching unfold around us, but you also get precedents. You also get to see similar situations occurring to different people in times past. So you can look at situations today and look for analogous situations, right? You can look for other situations with a lot of similarities. Probably one of the most popular and common ones is comparing the United States today to Rome when it was declining. That's one of the more common ones that people reach for. But there are lots of others, and I'm sure plenty of them will come up as this podcast keeps going. Not this particular episode, but, you know, as I keep cranking out episodes with more and more historical narratives. Some version of everything that is going on now, some version of it, it's not the exact same, but it's a version of it, has already happened. And it doesn't mean that it's going to play out exactly the same way, because, of course, there's too many variables for that to happen. But it can give you some ideas. It can give you some basic concepts. It can give you some basic sort of big picture notions of, okay, when, I don't know, two equally matched great powers go to war, how does it play out? Or how can it play out? Or when a former hegemonic power in a region starts to fall apart, what tends to occur when that happens? Or what are some possible scenarios that you can find of different ways it can play out depending on variables? Next, understand the present. Once you've learned the past, once you've learned the history about something or some phenomenon or some particular part of the world or something, whatever it is, then you can really start to get a better handle on the present. How in the world could you understand the Middle East if you're only looking at it from right now forward? Or even if you're only looking at it from the last decade or two forward, right? There's an old saying that most people's historical horizon does not extend prior to their birth. In fact, I don't think most people's historical horizon, to the degree that they have one at all, goes much beyond their early adult years. So I don't think a lot of people, at least not the majority of people, when they're 5 or 10, are following world events very much. You know, I mean, I know that there's weirdos that do at that age. I was one of them, but it's not typical. The rain's getting heavy, so we'll see how this works. We'll see if I can clean this up when I'm editing it or not. I'm going to do my best, but I only can do so much. Limited by skills and hardware. So, you've learned the past, now you can start to really understand the present with some real depth. What people think is really going on in the present, what people, most people, talk about as what is going on in the present, is not often what is really going on, or at least it's not often what's really important. They're oftentimes worried about trivial things. They're worried about surface details rather than about, you know, the real depth of what's really going on, why things are really happening the way they are. And I would argue that by truly understanding the present, you can really help yourself out in a lot of ways. One of the most simple ways that learning the past and understanding the present can help you out, which I've found in my own life as I've learned these lessons, is you can save yourself a hell of a lot of money and energy and heartache and resources and disappointments on things that either don't matter or that might matter, but there's absolutely shit all you can do about them, so you're better off not even investing much in them anyway. So for example, you or I, unless someone listening to this happens to be a multi-billion dollar campaign donor, you or I have fuck all of influence on what the real top people in our governments do, right? Especially if you're an American and you're talking about just an enormous country, an enormous government. I mean, again, unless you're like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates type wealthy, or you're at least the CEO of a monster corporation, the president, the top people in Congress, they're going to do what they're going to do. You can write the most elegant, persuasive letter to their staff in the fucking world, right? Pulitzer Prize winning letter saying, Senator, do this or don't do that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So if you pour a lot of your intellect and your energy and your skills into that kind of stuff, you are wasting it. It's what economists call an opportunity cost. Devoting resources to X means those same resources, by definition, are no longer available for Y, right? If you use all your money on one thing, you don't have that same money available for another thing, right? And all resources are scarce. All resources are scarce. Money, whatever, right? And of course, the most scarce resource of all, even more scarce than money, is time. You can figure out how to get more money. It's always going to be scarce because there's never enough money for what everybody wants all the time. But, and the same is true of every other resource, but the most scarce of all is always time, because you can't get back time. You can get back money. You can figure out a way to earn money back somehow. You can't really earn back time other than, I guess, if you're unhealthy and then you get healthier, you can theoretically extend your life, but then who's to say you won't just get, you know, some horrible accident, an anvil falls on you as you're walking down the street in Toontown, right? So when you have that deep understanding of the past, which then leads to a deep understanding of the present, what you can do is you can start to understand things that really matter and differentiate them from things that don't. And then further differentiate things you can actually have a real effect on from things that don't. And you can start gradually, as time goes on and you get more and more knowledgeable and skillful about this stuff, you can start to be way more efficient in what you do with your time and other resources, because you can just start giving less of a shit about the things that either don't matter or you have no effect on, or both. And you could zero in on more and more things that actually both matter and you can affect them. Okay? So rather than being obsessed with who wins the next presidential election, which obviously matters on a lot of levels, but you really don't have much effect on it. You really don't. In a country of a few hundred million people, your vote means dick all in the grand scheme of things. And again, unless you're the CEO of a top corporation or something, your money doesn't mean much either. So rather than focusing on that, you can focus in on whatever there might be closer to home. You can focus on things that actually will matter and that you actually can have a bigger effect on. You can focus on being a better in terms of your family life. You could focus on being a better parent. You can focus on developing more skill sets for yourself, your human capital. You can focus on becoming more self-sufficient, more self-reliant, and on and on and on, a whole bunch of other things. You can focus on just improving your own happiness. You can focus on, hey, I don't spend as much time doing things that just make me happy as I want to. And you can start to figure out how to change your life in ways that allow you to do more of the things you genuinely want to do and avoid as much as possible the things you genuinely don't want to do. That's something that actually matters a hell of a lot more to your life and something that you actually have a lot more real effect on than who wins some election for some distant high office. So just using that as an example. So yeah, you can understand the present and benefit from that in a lot of ways. To me, the most significant, it seems subtle at first, but when you start even to just take a few steps down this path and you start doing things like unplugging from day-to-day politics and that kind of nonsense and start focusing more on the things that matter, that are deep, that you can actually do stuff about, you'll find that it leads you to much more happiness and much more richness in your life, much more satisfaction and fulfillment as well. Because if you, and again, I'm speaking from experience, and I'm sure many of you have experiences like this. If you invest a lot of resources in getting somebody elected, sorry, the rain's getting really loud. If you invest a lot emotionally, in terms of energy, in terms of maybe money and time, in getting somebody elected, and they lose, you will suffer. You will face defeat, and it's not the same kind of defeat as if, you know, you go into a sport and you really give it your best, and you give it all your effort, and you compete honorably, and it just doesn't work out. You have this horrible sense of you've been defeated, and on some subconscious level, deep down, you know that what you did really didn't matter much one way or the other. You know it somewhere in your gut. Okay, now that I've made it through the absolutely blinding wall of water, I'm going to see if I can resume this and see how it goes. So as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted by nature, if you invest a lot of your resources, including time, money, energy, everything you can think of, emotion, into, let's just say, getting somebody elected to some office, right? If they fail, that's gonna fuck you up on some level to the degree that you've invested a lot of yourself into the campaign. It can't help but do that. Now, here's the real rub when we're talking about politics, right? Because politicians, I don't know if you know this, they're oftentimes full of shit. I know that'll shock you, right? And one of the ways in which they're the most full of shit is when it comes to, they say, hey, get me in office and I'll do X, Y, and Z. And then they get in office and they do the complete opposite of X, Y, and Z. Not only do they not do X, Y, and Z, they do the complete opposite, and they don't even make a token effort to actually do X, Y, and Z that got them elected, right? And let's be honest. I mean, what percentage of politicians does that on a regular basis? Well, I mean, minimum, I would imagine, 70-80%. Minimum. That'd be my guess. Well, maybe I'm more cynical than most, but so what if you put in all your resources to getting some politician elected and it actually works, and then the dude or gal gets in there and just completely fails to even make a genuine effort to make good on the things that they campaigned on, right? That's also gonna, you're gonna have two options there. Neither of them's good. The worst option is to completely just put on your blinders and pretend like this person is actually living up to what they said they would do. You see this right now with a lot of Obama supporters who are just in delusional fairy tale land that this guy is actually some kind of a civil libertarian liberal peacenik, right? That he's just a black version of Dennis Kucinich or something like that, when he, nothing could be further from the truth. When it comes to war and civil liberties, he's really more George W. Bush than he is Dennis Kucinich or Ralph Nader. Same thing with corporate welfare, too, by the way. But how many partisan Democrats continue to make excuses for Obama and continue to act like he's a total change of pace from George W. Bush, when in reality, on a lot of issues, he sure as hell isn't. More of the same. So that, to me, is the worst option, is just to completely delude yourself and act like the person is living up to what they said they would do. The other option, which still isn't great, but I think it's at least got the virtue of being honest, is to basically have your heart broken and to be pissed off and dejected that you invested resources into getting some jackass elected and they're totally failing to follow through on what they ran on. Wouldn't it be better if you just completely sidestepped all that nonsense altogether? If you just were oblivious to that, and if you just focused on the things that actually matter and that you can actually do something about. So I'll leave that for now. And then, of course, the last thing, and I've spoken about this in a few other podcasts, including the Fall of Rome one and the follow-up to that. In the future, I'm going to do some other podcasts that really have to do with this sort of disaster and collapse preparedness, having to do with other cases in history of this happening, including the European Dark Ages. I might go into those in even more detail that followed after the collapse of Rome. I just gave kind of a big picture overview of some of the negative trends and things that happened. But another one that I'm going to get into in probably a multi-episode mini-series not too far down the road, I just need to do a bit more research and preparation for it, is the so-called Bronze Age collapse around the 12th century BC, when a whole bunch of Bronze Age civilizations in kind of the Eastern Mediterranean and Middle East area all of a sudden all simultaneously had a civilizational collapse, where technology went backwards, population, learning, etc., all went backwards for a long time. This, by the way, the so-called Greek Dark Age, if you've ever studied the history of ancient Greece, you learn about the archaic age of the Mycenaeans and at the time of Agamemnon, and then there's this dark age of I don't know, 5-6 centuries, I think, something like that, and then you start to get the rebirth that gives us the classical age Greece of, you know, Socrates and all those guys. So that's a case where that might come up in the future. Anyway, preparing for the future. History gives us tastes, samples, examples of different potential future scenarios that, you know, obviously the world in terms of human society is different than it was a few thousand years ago or even a few hundred years ago. So you take that into account when you're thinking about these issues, but nonetheless, it can still give you kind of basic patterns and trends and chains of reaction and so on that you can use. It's not a crystal ball. It's not a magic Nostradamus thing, but it's kind of the best thing we have that I'm aware of to try and get a sense of where the future is going, so that you can figure out, again, using the ideas of what can you actually do and what will actually matter, you can then use your intelligent notions of what the future might potentially entail to be able to prepare accordingly. And again, that gets us back into sort of the prepper survivalist mindset. And again, I'm a moderate prepper survivalist. I'm not building a bunker under a mountain in Idaho or something like that. Maybe if I had mountains of money, I would consider doing that. Maybe I'm just caving into my meager means. But more moderate things, just being ready, just being aware, putting aside some resources, trying to get some skills when and where you can, not bankrupting yourself, not totally ruining your quality of life today to be prepared for potential problems, but taking rational and reasonable measures within your own life, within your own family, and maybe even your local community that can at least up your odds of weathering potential problems better than you otherwise would, I guess is the best way I could put it. When you start to really know history, and start to really, based on that, understand the present, you have a tendency, at least I did, and other people I've known or that I've been aware of have gone through a process where you start to become a hell of a lot more cynical, which to me just means more realistic. Get a little jaded. You realize that politicians' flowery rhetoric is just a bunch of bullshit to get votes. Doesn't mean anything substantive in the world. And so you start to get to where you can kind of understand what's really going on. You can see the stitches on the fastball as it's barreling in towards you. And when the stupid and or evil people who pretty much inevitably end up in charge whenever you've got coercion and hierarchy, when the stupid and or evil people in charge start to do an inordinate amount of stupid and or evil things, right? I mean, the stupid and or evil people at the top of human institutions are always doing stupid and or evil things, right? But there's times and places, there's instances when they seem to just go nuts with it. I mean, you could find times when they're doing stupid and evil things, but they're kind of at least keeping it on a certain limited level where it doesn't completely wreck society. You know, when you have statesmen who might be ruthless and might be occasionally incompetent, but they have this basic sense of prudence of not going too stupid or too evil and suiciding their society on which they parasitically exist. Right? But sometimes you get people in charge who don't even have that basic little instinctive prudence to not do that, where they just go nuts and vampire their own society to death, take themselves down with it in the process a lot of the time. Well, when this starts to happen, if you see it happening, and I think I and probably many of you see at least some instances of this kind of stuff happening in the present and in the near future. If you have learned the past, have come to understand the present, then you can start effectively preparing for the future. You can't save the big picture. You can't save the big picture, okay? If you're living in Rome in the 4th, early 5th century AD, if you're living in the Western Roman Empire, I don't care how smart and how hardworking and how sincere you are, you're not saving the Roman system, the Western Roman Empire. You're not going to. I don't care how brilliant and dedicated to that cause you are. Doesn't matter. And I would argue that applies to a lot of our problems today. They can't be solved in the sense of undoing them at the gigantic macro level. But maybe there's things that you can do if you were a person living in the Western Roman Empire during the collapse. Rather than focusing on who the next emperor is, you could focus on your immediate vicinity, your own life, your own immediate local community, family, and so on. Figuring out things you can do on a practical, realistic level to shelter yourself as best you can, to position yourself as best you can to get through it. Dark times are coming. You want some flashlights and some candles, metaphorically speaking, right? So by learning the past and understanding the present, we can prepare for the future in ways that actually make sense, by not trying to solve giant problems that cannot be solved. Instead, by focusing on things that we can actually do that actually matter. So I hope this has been something that's given you some food for thought. I hope that this tagline makes sense. I hope you don't get too annoyed in the future if I repeat it too much. I apologize ahead of time for that. I appreciate you listening. There are lots of ways you can support the show if you want to help it to continue to grow. It's been growing at a very fast rate, month to month, day to day. I've really been impressed by it. You can spread it word of mouth or word of, you know, blog or tweet, Facebook, whatever you've got. Try and spread it to other people you think might want to listen to it. That's great. You can donate. There's a donate thing to click on Pages on the homepage of the website, or you can put in profcj.org/donate. You can also purchase some Amazon things by going through the links that I have on a lot of the show episodes to books related to books and movies related to whatever I was covering in that episode. And I'll get a little kickback from Amazon. Not a whole lot, but something at no extra cost to you, by the way, if you're already thinking about buying some of that stuff or anything else on Amazon. Another thing you can do to help support and grow the show is write a review or even just give a rating on iTunes so that other people, when they find the show on iTunes, will be more likely to give it a shot. I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave comments in any of the show episode notes. Also, feel free to email me, profcj@profcj.org, and you can also follow me on Twitter. There's a widget on the profcj.org website. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.